I got questions of like, did you vote for Trump? Have you ever shot a gun? Things that I would feel, or maybe not polite conversation question. People felt comfortable saying those to me, I guess because of the idea they had in their head of what Appalachia is like and what an Appalachian is.
Emily Hackney, welcome to Settle In. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I am thrilled to talk to you today.
So I should start with congratulations. This is your first book. It is a memoir. It's called All That's Unseen, an Appalachian memoir. How does it feel to have a book, your story, out in the world?
Absolutely surreal and a little bit scary. Memoir, I think, is its own special genre where people are not just judging me on my writing, but also on the way I've lived my life. So there's an extra layer to that. That fear of having myself out in the world, but also it's exhilarating.
So it is about your life growing up in southwestern Virginia in a town called Tazewell, right? In Appalachia. I think it's fair to say a lot of people have ideas about Appalachia, about what life there is like, about what people there are like. And you've probably bumped up against those ideas a lot in your life. I'm curious how you think those ideas that other people have about where you grew up, how those line up with what life is really like on the ground.
When I left Appalachia for the first time, when I went to Harvard, I was 20 years old. I'd never really spent any significant time outside of Appalachia, and I'd always heard that people outside Appalachia had ideas about what it was like there. And I never encountered that before. So when I actually did, it was so jarring. It seemed like in everybody's mind's eye, Appalachia is full of people who are very poor, very white, very drug addicted, very Republican. And, there might be something to those stereotypes, but not as much as people think. It was disappointing to know that there is such a flat, singular image of what Appalachia is. And when that was projected onto me, it was just very disconcerting. It just did not feel true to my identity. So it was a difficult stereotype to encounter.
So, for someone who's never been, tell me about life in Tazewell, Virginia. How would you describe it?
Very slow pace of life. I think there might be three stoplights that I can think of. it's very slow. It's both a coal mining town and an agricultural town. There's a little bit of both. Not very many people. I graduated with 115 in my high school. It's a pe very peaceful place, but also it's a place where people don't often leave. And if they do leave, they usually don't come back. But it's the kind of place that's it's it can be difficult to leave because it's isolated from the interstate. The closest big city to us was an hour and a half away. So it can feel like an all-consuming place. It can feel very small, despite its peacefulness and its natural beauty, the mountains. It's both things.
One of the things that strikes me from your book is how much storytelling you grew up around. I mean, you talk about sort of this seems to be a tradition of oral history and oral storytelling. Your grandmother telling you stories about like the time she saw a snake swallow a bird whole, like all these tales that you're told about life there and what people have seen and lived through. I wonder if A, you agree with that there is that tradition there, and how those stories shape your own understanding of your home, of your life.
Yeah, I mean, Appalachian storytelling. I feel like that's probably a big way that people used to pass the time is just telling stories. My dad was a huge storyteller. He loved to make up all these stories about monsters in the woods, and he really played on that sense of Appalachian wilderness and supernatural elements of the wilds. And he loved to make up those stories. My grandma, she would tell me stories about coal miners and like this is what happened at this mine. So I grew up around all these stories of like what possibilities there were in the Appalachian wilderness, and just I don't know. I guess the stories always made me feel like Appalachia was kind of haunted and wild, and there was a lot about it that couldn't be known. And it gave me this sense of curiosity that I think played into my own life. As a child, I wrote a lot of stories and wanted to make up things and had a huge imagination. And I'm sure that that contributed to me becoming a writer. You know, later in my life, I had this very innate sense of storytelling that was given to me by my family and by, lots of people I grew up around. So yeah, I think that I would have to attribute a lot of this book, the way that it was written and me writing it, to those early stories that were told to me, that tradition of storytelling.
You also write about there were times when your parents struggled to provide for you and your brother. You write about noticing some of your birthday money stash had gone missing, learning your parents had gone into your and your brother's piggy banks for some money to help buy groceries, to help pay the mortgage. I mean, really doing everything they could to make ends meet. What did those moments tell you and teach you about poverty, about wealth? How did you come to look at that?
You know, at the time, as a child, I wouldn't say that our situation was much more unusual than, our neighbors or friends. I think it was a very common thing and still is, to live paycheck to paycheck and to struggle. And growing up like that with that fear of, my dad losing his job or jobs being difficult to come by, money not always being available. Sometimes it is available, sometimes it's not. Even into adulthood, I think that it's given me this sense of instability. You know, now I have a job, and I have a house, and I have my own family, but there's always this sense of things could just fall apart at any moment. I might not have a job. I might not have the money to pay for, what I need to. So
You
I
still
think
have
that
that today.
I do, yeah. And I think that poverty, while even though my family was not always impoverished, and that even still feels like a very strong word to me because we always had everything that we needed. And my parents, like you said, made do with what they had and provided. There are still worries about money. I don't know if that ever will leave me. I don't know if that's something that I can overcome, that sense of instability.
And you write about that too as your circumstances change. That struck me because when your father does go on to get a relatively well-paying administrative job at a coal mine there, and you write, the shame of being poor was nothing like the shame of being rich. What did you mean by that?
I don't want to say poverty was the standard because that's not true, but most people I knew were living on lower incomes. And that's how it was in my hometown. And to make something higher than that, to make more money than that, it was almost a shameful thing to be better than. It was like you were considered better than. Almost than the average. And I write a little bit about how my friend's dad kind of looked down on the fact that I got to go shopping outside of like Christmas holiday season, because that wasn't always something that was done, and a lot of people weren't able to do that.
It's more about how other people see you. Is that right? That they would judge you for feeling like you might consider yourself better than them.
Yeah, I guess it was a projection of insecurity almost. About your financial situation.
You write a lot about your faith too, and it played a huge role in how you were raised, and in the community around you. Tell us about the church and the system you were raised in. What did you learn through your faith experience there?
So I went to a Pentecostal church almost every Sunday as a child. My mom went, my brother went, and my dad didn't go. He'd been raised Pentecostal, but he thought that we needed church, but maybe he didn't at that point in his life. So church was non-negotiable. And it was the kind of church that, on the surface, was very contemporary. So there was contemporary Christian rock. The pastor, he would wear jeans sometimes. There were younger families. It was certainly marketed towards a younger generation. And it was kind of a novelty where we grew up or where I grew up. It was a different kind of church and ended up growing very quickly because of that. It was just something that people hadn't experienced before. It wasn't, Baptist. It wasn't Methodist. It was non-denominational, even though it was actually associated with the Pentecostal church. So I think that the contemporary elements of it drew people in, but under the surface, there were a lot of fundamentalist ideas that were being pushed. There were a lot of implicit messages about gender roles and family dynamics, and yeah, there's just this element of fundamentalism that lay underneath the contemporary veneer.
What were some of those lessons, though? Like, what did you believe to be true about a marriage, or your place in a relationship, or your role as a woman?
I grew to believe that that men were wiser than women, that they had an innate authority and wisdom that women didn't have, and therefore they should lead women. They should be the head of the household. They should, be a man and take charge. So there were these very traditional gender roles that were being pushed. And like I said, not always explicitly, but there was that implicit underlying message. It was very subtle and it was very sneaky. And then you could see that acted out in marriages of people that were attending that church.
And how did that all make its way into your first big relationship? There's a guy you meet through your high school, right? Named Sam. You're 14 when you meet him. He's 18 at the time. How does all of that, what you've learned about your role as a woman in society and in a relationship, how does that feed into the relationship?
Yeah, it made me feel immediately like I should defer to him. I should let this older man lead me, tell me what's right. I believe that because he was older, because he was a man, he had this wisdom that I didn't have. And so I ended up falling very deeply into this relationship very fast, because I thought that was right and I believed what he told me. Yeah, it immediately set me on a very unhealthy dynamic in my relationship with him because of these roles, these gender roles that I believed in, these traditional values.
There's this aspect, there's a phrase you use in there that the pastor had brought up, or that Sam brings up. The pastor had brought up a domestic discipline. What does that mean? And how does he interpret it? How do you interpret it in your relationship?
Yeah, so that scene, there's a guest evangelist that came to visit our church. I did not see him. I skipped that sermon. But my fiance at the time, Sam, he went to the sermon. He spoke with the pastor afterwards, after the sermon, and he learned about this thing called domestic discipline. And purportedly, it was something that this evangelist practiced in his own marriage, and it supposedly helped them stay happy. It was a dynamic in which the husband disciplines his wife physically, and that manifested as spanking. And it was a way to, more or less keep a woman in line. It was, framed as a way to help your wife become more holy, more like Jesus, less sinful. But really, underneath that, it's just a way to make her more subservient. It's a way to make her a little fearful, not just of sinning, but of her husband.
And that become a part of your relationship with Sam?
It did. It did. So he was the one that introduced me to it. And very disturbingly to me now, I really took to it. I believe this is right. This is the way to have a better relationship because our relationship was very unhealthy, like I mentioned, and we had a lot of difficulties and struggles. And I just saw it as being something that could probably help us because that was how it was told. That was how it was sold to him. He brought it up to me. That's how it sold to me. And because I believe that he is wise and has this authority, I trust him. I believe that that's true. This is what we should do. This will make us happy.
I mean, you do stay together for years. You do end up getting engaged, as you mentioned. But when you first meet, you're 14 and he's 18. Did anyone around you think he's too old for you? This is a bad idea. Did that ever come up?
My parents immediately said, "This is not right. This is not good." But they are some of the few people that discourage that relationship. And I think that's because I'm not going to say it's common, and I'm not going to say that it's like the standard thing to do, but I knew a lot of people who were married young, a lot of women who were married young to older men. I had a friend in high school that I write about. She was married at 16. I have cousins and aunts that were married as teenagers, my grandparents, my father's parents. So it wasn't uncommon. But yeah, when you see that this is something that people do and not just one or two people, it kind of plants a seed in your head, like this is an okay thing to do. And I had friends at the time who were dating much older guys. We were in high school, they'd be dating guys like in college, out of college. So yeah, it wasn't unusual.
So at this moment in time, your life is sort of on a certain path, right? You're with Sam, you're deeply embedded in this church community. Sam becomes your fiance, you go to community college. What happens that tells you it is time to change all of that, to break with Sam and maybe leave Tazewell?
We were about 2.5 weeks from our wedding when he got arrested.
He turns out to be not at all the person you thought he was. He's
Not at
basically been
all.
kind of living a double life, we'll
Yes,
say.
lying. Yeah, I was blindsided. I was horrified. My entire world felt like it turned upside down. And after that betrayal, I had people in church that encouraged me to go back to him. And that started to open my eyes to maybe this is not really what I think it is. Maybe this church that I'm involved in, these beliefs that I'm involved in, are not as good as I believe them to be. So I decided to leave my church. And once I did that, I really didn't know what to do. All my friends were in church. I lost them. I was working at Subway at the time, and I knew I didn't want to work there forever. I was in community college and didn't really have a plan, a path forward. I thought about dropping out of school, but I just kept going because I didn't know what else to do with my life. I was just, spinning my wheels. I felt like I had no purpose anymore now that I wasn't going to get married, and that had been my whole purpose in life up till then. It felt like, and what do you do now? So I kept going to community college. I eventually decided maybe I'll apply to college and like try to get out of Tazewell, try something different because I'm still surrounded by these people that I went to church with that I'm no longer friends with. The church is a big influence in my community. It's like I can't escape what happened. I can't escape the past. So maybe I need to physically go somewhere else. I need to leave. That influenced me to apply to college.
Had you seen other people around you who'd done similar moves, who'd made it out and broken with the community in the past?
I knew a few people who had. There were a few people I can think of that I went to school with that just left. They left completely. They went to college and they never came back. And the scary thing about that, for me considering to do that myself, was those people were kind of not looked down upon, but it was almost as if they had left and everybody that stayed didn't trust them as much anymore, or they were just seen as different. Like, oh, they went away. They don't belong here anymore. They're too good for us. That was kind of the thing. That was the thing that I thought of growing up. Anybody that left, they're a little weird, and they don't belong. We didn't want them here anyway. It was almost that kind of attitude. So it
And you
was,
didn't want to be seen that way. Because
yeah.
if you didn't belong there, then where do you belong?
Exactly. It's like this is my home. This is what I've spent 20 years, this is the place I've spent 20 years of my life. If I don't belong here and I go to college and I don't come back, or even if I do come back and I don't belong anymore, then where do I belong? And that's exactly what I ended up encountering.
I mean, understandably, in all of that turmoil and uncertainty at the time, a lot of the mental health struggles that you'd earlier been dealing with and been told just to kind of, just pray harder and God will help you take care of it, they resurface and in very severe and very worrying ways. And you start to think about self-harm and you think about ways that you might end your life. How do you reach a point where you know that you need help?
I don't necessarily know if it was me knowing that I needed to, but at the time, I go up to Harvard. I have all these very difficult mental health struggles. I had made one friend the first semester that I was there, and he ended up becoming my boyfriend, and he pointed out to me that I was not doing very well. And like logically, I knew that, but I had a really deep distrust of the mental health system because I'd had such a negative experience with it back home. Never really able to get the help that I needed, it seemed like. So it took somebody else pointing out to me that maybe I needed to reach out and get some help and find some resources. Then I finally became aware that, yeah, maybe I do.
I was actually wondering first about the moment when you were still back in Tazewell and you decided to try to go and find some help and kind of end up running into a system where you feel like, oh, this is actually not going to help me at all. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so I first decided to go after I had these, self-harm thoughts. I decided to reach out to a local, I'm not sure what you call it, mental health services board. And they weren't able to take me as a client, which was very deeply embarrassing to me because I'd already struggled with the idea of whether I should even go or not, because I had these ideas ingrained in me that if I just pray harder, or if I just, trust in God more, then I'll be healed. I'll be okay. So reaching out was already a scary thing, and when it didn't work out, I just felt so deeply embarrassed, and ashamed, and kind of beyond help. And then when I tried to reach out again, and I'm denied help again, it was this moment of like, okay, this entire system's broken. Like I cannot get help this way. So now what? I don't know. And I just felt very lonely. I felt very on my own and yeah, beyond help.
There is this portrait you paint of a young woman who's sort of yearning to break free and sort of stuck in the momentum of it all. And you do end up applying to transfer to Harvard of all places. Why Harvard?
Well, so yeah, so I decided to apply to college because I didn't know what else to do, right? Like I didn't know what else my future was going to be. And I applied to a few in-state schools for the tuition. And I had a little bit of spending money left over for the applications. And Harvard, that was something I joked about with my former fiance. And he discouraged me from applying, not just to Harvard, but to anywhere. He didn't believe that I was capable of like having any kind of career. He was just very, very negative towards any of my ambitions. And in one of those conversations we had, I made a joke that I was going to apply to Harvard, and he was like, "You couldn't get in." And I was like, "Well, I didn't plan to try. I was kind of trying to lighten the mood here, but it didn't work out. You didn't get the joke." So I had that in my head, once I broke up with him, didn't know what else I was going to do. I was applying to colleges, and I was still very, very upset with him at the time. We'd broken up less than a year earlier. So I had that in my head, and I thought, I'll just apply to Harvard and see what happens. I did
Sort of
not
to spite
think,
him, maybe, or the memory of
yeah,
him.
spite, but I mean, I didn't seriously think I could get in. I didn't even really take the application that seriously. I mean, I applied the night of the deadline, just kind of like throwing it into the wind and hoping something would happen.
When you get in, what's that like? What do you think?
He probably took me days before I actually believed I was in. I was like, is this a hallucination? Did I dream this? This is insane. I was just shocked. I really thought I had no chance at all. Yeah, it was beyond surreal. And then actually moving up there, I felt, oh, this is real. I'm actually here. How did this happen? It was just mind-bending that it had.
Yeah, and it's not an easy transition, right? I mean, what is that first like when you arrive and you start to meet people from all different kinds of backgrounds and all different lived experiences, and they start to meet you? What is that like for you?
That was also a very surreal experience. I felt like I'd been dropped on another planet. Just meeting all kinds of people from all different backgrounds I'd never met before, never encountered so many different kinds of cultures or languages. It was exhilarating in a way because this is so new. This is great meeting all these different people, but also it very quickly became it became what's the word for it? I just felt a little bit exoticized myself because my accent, people immediately picked up on it and went, "Oh, where are you from?" I say, "Appalachia," and then they've got this idea in their head of what that means, what Appalachia is. And suddenly I'm a stereotype. I'm kind of flattened in their eyes. I got questions of like, "Did you vote for Trump? Have you ever shot a gun?" Things that I would feel are maybe not polite conversation question. People felt comfortable saying those to me, I guess, because of the idea they had in their head of what Appalachia is like and what an Appalachian is.
And when you're getting those kinds of questions and you're starting to get a sense of how people see you or things that they assume about you, does that then make it harder to fit in, to feel like you belong, to make a home?
Definitely. It just made me feel immediately that there was this impenetrable wall between me and whoever I was speaking to. It's like they didn't really see me as a person. They just saw the accent and the associations that they made with the accent and my background. So most people that I encountered up there, it felt almost impossible to relate to them because I just felt like they didn't see me as a person.
There are struggles there you document, and again, that your storytelling is so vivid and so intimate and so vulnerable. You talk about trying to make friends and the few friends you make and the guy you date, going to parties and trying different things, but it's a very solitary existence, it sounds like. And in it leads you sort of down another self-destructive path, right? Where you do find yourself sleeping with strangers for money at some point. There are moments where it feels like you're really trying to figure out where the limits of your lows might be. Is that a fair way for me to characterize? I mean, what is going on in your mind and in your heart at those moments?
I think that's absolutely fair to characterize it that way. That couldn't be more accurate. I mean, I think it was a continuation of this thing that had started probably early in my life in the church, thinking of men as strong and authoritative and wise and being able to lead the way. There's this association of, I guess I had this thought, like men can comfort me, like this is where I turn to when I need help. And so the unhealthy relationship dynamic that had started, in the church with Sam, it continues on to these strange men. Because that's where I'd thought this is where I can find some sort of solace. This is the one place I know that I will be able to find comfort or help or, whatever you want to call it.
Writing, though, writing offers you a haven. How so?
Yeah, it does. And I was very grateful to discover that. I started out in a bunch of biology classes at Harvard, immediately started failing those. So I had to find another path of what can I do to stay here and also stay sane. And I ended up taking, a writing class, some English classes, and I found out that writing about my life in Appalachia and what Appalachia was like, that became my comfort. That was a way for me to start to feel some sense of belonging on that campus where I just felt so lonely all the time.
And the essays that you're writing there, I mean, those are eventually what go on to become this memoir. Did you see that back then as you were writing them?
No, not at all. I would have never guessed that, these little essays that I'm writing for class, these 5-page, 6-page essays, would eventually become chapters of this book, but quite a few of them did. So, yeah, I would have never expected that to have happened without some encouragement.
I mean, there are throughout, Emily, undeniable cultural and these days like political cultural themes throughout the stories that you tell. And you talk about hearing folks back at home as they're learning about candidate Donald Trump, President Donald Trump, about him gaining popularity in Appalachia. They like that he told it like it is, things we've heard in a lot of communities where he has strong levels of support. Did his strength and his support in the place that you call home, did all that make sense to you at the time?
Absolutely. I mean, most of the people I knew were Trump supporters right from the very beginning because he comes to Appalachia and he says, "I'm going to help you." He pays attention. He makes us feel seen for the first time in decades. And when you are coming from a place that's really struggling, like Appalachia often does, or at least Coalfield, Appalachia, you have to trust in whoever offers you hope, because what else is there? What else do you hope in? So, yeah, at first I was like, maybe this is the way. Maybe he's actually going to help. Maybe this is right. And I read about going to a rally that he held in Southwest Virginia at Radford University, and feeling just the tension of that room didn't feel right to me. And the way that he behaved, like seeing him in person, kind of turned me off from the idea of him. But if I hadn't gone to that rally, I don't know if I think it would have taken me a longer time to change my opinion of him. And even still, when I was at Harvard, I still had conflicted feelings about him, because so many people I knew back home were still so supportive of him. And he was early in his first presidency. And, you know, we've seen him do a lot of things that now I'm like, oh my gosh, how could I ever have supported him? But at that point, it hadn't gotten to that point yet. And so I had these conflicted feelings about him. And once I started really looking into his policies, or lack thereof, in one of my writing classes, in my investigative journalism class, that was what finally, I guess, made me move, and started to move me in a different direction.
You've probably seen the comparisons being made now, right, between your book and the book written by Vice President Vance, Hillbilly Elegy, about his time growing up in Appalachia and then in Ohio. Do you buy those comparisons? Do you agree with them?
He makes a lot of generalizations about Appalachia based on his own experiences, his own anecdotal experiences. And I don't feel like those are fair characterizations to make. I think that he probably encountered a lot of what I did. So I go up to Harvard, he goes to Yale, and he writes about being an oddity to people at Yale, to New Englanders. And, you know, I felt that way too. And I encountered this big appetite for, what is Appalachia? Like, what are people like? You know, everybody has a stereotype in their head, but I think that he saw that people wanted to know more about Appalachia and those stereotypes, because we were on the heels of the 2016 election. Appalachia was being talked about as, you know, being so red, so Trump supporting. I just feel like he capitalized on that appetite, and he saw that people wanted to know more about Appalachia, but maybe not really. They just wanted confirmation of what they already thought about it. And I think he plays into those stereotypes by using his own stories from his childhood to say, like, all of Appalachia is, you know, addicted. Like, addiction is endemic. It's such a problem. It's all over. Poverty is so widespread. And I just feel like that's a flattened and non-nuanced characterization of Appalachia. He cannot speak for Appalachia as a whole, as he does in his book.
You feel like his anecdotes, his story, don't directly relate to what you experienced growing up in a different part of Appalachia. Is that fair?
It is. Yeah, I don't think that his story could speak for anybody else's. So in my book, I'm very careful to say, this isn't my experience in Appalachia. It's not going to be everybody's. And I don't think that he does the same thing. He's not careful that same way.
I mean, the book is called All That's Unseen. It's this idea of being seen, of being heard. I mean, there are more than 26 million people who call the Appalachian region home. What is unseen that you are trying to get people to see?
There are a lot of elements of the book that went into that title. So first and foremost, I would like for people to understand that Appalachia is not just one thing. It's not just the stereotype in your head. And there can be a lot of different experiences of what Appalachia is based on, you know, what family you're born into, or where in Appalachia you're born, or where you go to school, whether you get an education or not. You know, I know that my story is exceptional in that I went to Harvard, and a lot of people from the Appalachian coalfields don't, and may not even go to college. So I know that my story is a little different in that way, but I want people to know that Appalachia it's seen a certain way, but there are other ways to see it. So that was the main, that was what I was thinking about when I was naming this book.
You also write at the end about losing your father very young, right? He was just 53 years old when he suffered a heart attack. And you pick up on this old idea that the two of you had to hike the Appalachian Trail. Tell me why and what that was like.
That was something that we just kind of played around with, that idea of hiking the Appalachian Trail. And when I say we played around with that idea, like, we never went backpacking. I'd never went backpacking. So it was just something we talked about. It was just an ideal that we could do one day. But after he passed away, I was in grad school at the time. But I quickly dropped out. I didn't feel like I could do it anymore. And I decided to go hike the Appalachian Trail kind of in honor of him. It was just a way to process my grief, I suppose. So I went and did the whole thing somehow. Like I said, I'd never been backpacking before. And I was kind of out of my mind with grief. I was like, I'm going to go do this. And then I did.
I mean, it is really hard, right? It is not an easy trail. How long did it take you to do that whole thing?
It was about 5.5 months. It's around 2,200 miles.
That is a pilgrimage of sorts. Why do that? What do you think you processed or were able to do in carrying out that journey?
It was a way to process my grief, mainly because it was such a shock for my dad to pass away so young when he was so perfectly healthy, and then one day he's suddenly not here anymore. And I guess my grief around that was so big. I felt like I had to do something big to not necessarily overcome grief, because I don't think that's possible, but just as a way to deal with it. And I didn't feel like I could deal with it by continuing on the way that I had, which was going to school and just living normal everyday life, paying bills. And, you know, I just didn't feel like I could do that anymore. So this was a way of, I don't know, it's an alternate way of processing grief.
You have your own family now, right?
I do.
You are a mother. Mm-hmm. How old?
My daughter is 6 months.
Your daughter is just 6 months old. Yes. How is she doing?
She is great. Well, she's teething right now, so she's maybe not as great as she was a couple weeks ago. But yeah.
Everything is a phase, I should tell you. Everything is a phase.
Yes.
How are you doing? How has becoming a mother changed you in your own life now, but also how you look back at your own early life?
Yeah, that's such an interesting question, because I feel like there are so many things you can't or you don't realize about your childhood, or that you start seeing in a different light once you have children of your own. Like, just I guess it makes more sense to me now. Not that it didn't before, but, you know, when my parents had to do like everything they could, like, you know, use my brother's birthday money to pay the bills. It's like I've begun to understand how you would just go to the ends of the earth for your child. You would do anything you could to provide for them and keep them happy and safe. That really rings true for me now than more than ever that I have my own daughter.
You also end in the book with your reflections about your home and the place you grew up. You have this paragraph I want to share here with folks, because you say, I could never stay gone from the mountains for long. My dear Appalachia, so painful and holy. I loved it despite needing something it couldn't give me, something I couldn't even name. How would you describe your relationship today, with the benefit of time and distance, with this place that you call home?
Even with the time and distance, I feel like my relationship with it's still pretty similar. It's complicated. It's a place that I love so dearly, and I feel so rooted in it. I just, like I said, I feel it deeply in my bones. And I love it, and I still feel like I'm part of it. But at the same time, it's a difficult place for me to live, and I don't feel like it's the right place for me to be at this point in my life. I feel like having a daughter, wanting to give her the best opportunities as possible. I want her to be more exposed to the outside world, and I want her to be exposed to a lot of different ideas and places and backgrounds, different people that maybe I wasn't when I was younger. My relationship with Appalachia is complicated because I love it so much, and also I still feel that feeling of not getting everything I want from it.
Do you feel like you could ever go back? Is that something you think about?
I think about it a lot. My husband and I talk about it a lot. He's also from Southwest Virginia. And we also talk about how it's kind of a difficult place to reckon with because our political views don't align with like the majority political views there. And where we've lived outside of Appalachia, and we've both lived in major cities, we've lived around the United States, it feels kind of confining, or it feels difficult to go back to such a small town where you know everybody and everybody knows you. It just feels like there's more out there to experience than living in a small town in Appalachia will allow. So I don't know what it would be like to go back home at this point in my life. Maybe when I'm older, I don't know. It's just an open-ended question for me.
One of the things I found to be true about becoming a mother was you grow this urge for your children to understand you as a person separate from their mother. And I know your daughter's very young, so I don't know if you felt that yet. But what would you want her to understand about you and where you come from and the place you call home?
I think I'd want her to understand, hopefully, what I convey in the book, that despite being from a place, you don't necessarily like have to live up to the expectations of what being from that place means. You can be your own person. You don't have to live up to any kind of stereotype. And I would hope that she would understand that Appalachia is just a very complicated place. And I would hope that she would come to understand, like I do, that you don't have to understand Appalachia.
Has anyone from back home read the book? Have you gotten any feedback from people you grew up with or people who are still there?
I've had quite a few people that I knew of in Tazewell, or even if I didn't know them directly, I'd heard like their name before. I've had several people reach out to me and say, I can't wait to read this book. I had one woman reach out and say, I grew up in Tazewell. I have struggled with the religious influence of the same church that I grew up in. She's like, I'm really looking forward to reading this book and understanding my own experience better through your experience. So that was a really touching message to know that somebody else has had a similar experience to me and is also trying to process it, and that maybe my story can help her understand her own.
In writing a memoir, it probably becomes very clear, and I've heard this from other folks who've done the same endeavor, how simple decisions or even just one big decision completely changed the course of your life. And in your case, leaving home, breaking from the past, breaking from your faith tradition, going to another school, all of that seems to have created a completely different life than you otherwise would have had. Do you ever think about that sliding door kind of moment? Like, what would your life look like today if you hadn't left, if you hadn't made those decisions along the way?
I do think about that, and I don't think about it extensively because it's kind of scary to me.
Scary? Like, how?
So if my fiance had not been arrested right before our wedding, I would have married him. And I think that we would have had children. You know, I very strongly bought into the idea of like a woman's purpose is to be a good wife and a good mother and have lots of children. So I think we would have had children. And I don't know at what point I would have, or if ever, I would have become disillusioned with that life. Like if I had not left and seen that there were different ways of living and different ways of believing, I don't know that I would have started to question the way I was living. I don't know if I would have eventually become pretty unhappy. I don't know. I had this idealistic version in my head of what our marriage and relationship would be like, and that felt like my purpose. And so if that had never been called into question and, you know, kind of thrown on its head, I don't know. I don't know that I ever would have left.
It's a very different life you lead now. You have a lot of life left to live. And we're really, really grateful to you for sharing this part of it in the book. The book is All That's Unseen, an Appalachian memoir, and the author is Emily Hackney. And Emily, it has been a real pleasure being able to speak with you. Thank you so much for making the time.
Thank you so much for letting me speak to you today. I really appreciate it.